The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Ministering to a Divided Nation today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A pastor says his congregation worries about a Trump presidency, but he urges dialogue.
There is also a recognition that there is common cause among some of the desires and hopes of Trump supporters and some of the desires and hopes of folks who supported Hillary Clinton.
Plus, some immigrants say they'll resist efforts to deport them.
If they think that we're going to go quietly into the night without putting up a fight, they're wrong.
And a survivor of the Paris attacks reflects on a tough year.
I was overwhelmed by all the emotions, a year of emotion, the fear, the mourning of the people who died there, the guilt of being alive and not dead.
That's all today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Glad you could make it here today. It's not even been a full week since Donald Trump's election, but we're starting to get some idea of what he plans to do once he gets into the White House. On immigration, for example, early in the campaign, Trump threatened to deport all of the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. Last night, speaking to CBS 60 Minutes, he narrowed that down.
What we are going to do is get the people that are criminal and have criminal records, gang members, drug dealers. We have a lot of these people, probably 2 million. It could even be 3 million. We're getting them out of our country or we're going to incarcerate. But we're getting them out of our country. They're here illegally.
We should note here that right now under President Obama, undocumented immigrants with a criminal record are already subject to incarceration or deportation. We're going to start today with reaction to President-elect Trump's immigration plans. Pablo Alvarado is head of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network. He joins us from Los Angeles. What's been the reaction among your members, Pablo? I'm assuming you have many members who are undocumented.
The majority of our members don't have documents. And a significant number of them are legal permanent residents or U.S. citizens as well. The wave of fear that the president-elect's announcement has created can be felt throughout. It's not just the undocumented community. So there is uncertainty, there is fear, but there is also resignation and willingness to fight back, you know. The reality is that for a day laborer, the day starts the same before Trump won. It's essentially the same. You know, people have to go every day to street corners to seek an honest day of work, regardless, you know, of what Trump does or doesn't. People have to feed their loved ones. So day laborers every day defy any obstacle you can think of. The rain, they defy the sun. They defy unscrupulous employers who oftentimes fail to pay their wages. They defy white supremacist organizations that come and harass them to the day labor corners. And they face a myriad of uncertainties every day. They don't know if they're going to get hired or not. They don't know if they're going to have an injury at the workplace and if they're going to receive proper medical care. So the life of a day laborer is, you know, an ocean of uncertainties.
So one more fear on top of a myriad of other fears.
Correct.
For an undocumented day laborer who is not a felon, does that provide any consolation? Because Donald Trump's comments seem to focus on people with criminal records.
No, it doesn't. Because the concept of who is a criminal can be easily changed. At a given moment, standing on a sidewalk to solicit employment was a crime. And as a consequence, you know, people like day laborers could be easily criminalized and deported. Plus, most undocumented people live in mixed households. So you have all kinds of people in one's extended family. So it's not, nobody is safe in this case.
Would you say that there is more fear now than in past episodes where raids and deportation have been, you know, on the horizon?
Absolutely. There's more fear now. The threat is much bigger. Remember that handful of xenophobes and nativists are essentially controlling not just the White House. They're controlling Congress, and now they're going to have a shot at controlling the Supreme Court. This is essentially the nativists taking over everything. Of course, there is widespread fear, but there is also, you know, there will be widespread resistance to whatever they do. If they think that we're going to go quietly into the night without putting up a fight, they're essentially wrong. We will fight in every setting possible, always as we have done it, in a peaceful and orderly manner.
Pablo Alvarado, head of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, speaking with us from Los Angeles. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are also questions about how quickly President-elect Trump could implement changes to U.S. immigration policy. After all, he, like any president, must work within the limits prescribed by existing law. We reached out to Daniel Kanstrom to talk about this. He's a law professor here in Boston College. I mean, due process, being heard before a judge, aren't these protections that even the president can't take away no matter what?
Well, yes, that's true. But in some cases, the opportunity to speak to a judge can be of little meaning if you don't have a substantive claim to stay in this country. And part of the difficulty is that the immigration laws of the United States are quite harsh. Actually, if you compare them to laws that are in place in Europe, the recognition of the importance of family unity, for example, is much less strong in the United States than it is there. So many of these people may have the right to say something, but then it's not clear what they could say that would actually count as a defense.
I mean, there's already a backlog on deportation hearings. Won't that just increase as soon as Donald Trump is president?
Yes, the backlog is actually a very serious problem. I suppose, in theory, if he wanted to devote unlimited resources to deporting people, he could do that, although I think he would need congressional authorization once he started spending that sort of money. Some of the estimates I heard, and this is maybe 3 or 4 years ago, were up in the hundreds of billions of dollars. You know, when people had tried to sort of cost this out, what would it look like if you did create a deportation strike force and start to go after the undocumented population? And it's not a trivial problem to also mention that the effect on the rights of U.S. citizens in such a regime would be very, very problematic. I mean, non-citizens are part of our community. They are married to U.S. citizens. They have U.S. citizen parents, children. How do you untangle that? What sort of police department, what sort of deportation force could do that without also trampling on the rights of U.S. citizens?
So what can Donald Trump do by executive order on the 20th of January that most concerns you? Like, he takes the oath of office, goes into the Capitol building rotunda. What can he do on day one?
Well, he can repeal some of the initiatives that President Obama did, the DACA and so-called DAPA programs.
DACA, that's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and DAPA is the Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, those two Obama programs.
Those could be repealed because they were executive orders to begin with. And I think that's a cause for great, great anxiety among many people. I mean, the numbers are a little hard to assess, but we know that there were hundreds of thousands of people who had applied for these programs and who had felt a certain safety and a certain kind of possibility of moving forward with their lives. And now they face the prospect of that all being snatched away from them. So he could do that. What he could not do is change the fundamental deportation laws of this country, and he can certainly not repeal the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and other constitutional protections.
I mean, Obama has earned the nickname Deporter-in-Chief, even though he was the originator of DAPA and DACA. What is the chance, you think, that in the end, Trump's immigration policies might not look all that different from Obama's?
Well, I think they're going to look different. I think it's going to look much harsher, much more vigorous, but I don't think it's going to be that dramatic a change because, as you say, the deportation mechanism has been humming along during the Obama administration already. But there could definitely be an uptick in the harshness of the enforcement and the vigor of the enforcement.
Boston College law professor Daniel Kanstrom, his most recent book is called Aftermath, Deportation Law and the New American Diaspora. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Even before last Tuesday, there were some churches across the U.S. that had offered undocumented immigrants a sanctuary from deportation. Last week's stunning election results have prompted others to take action now. One example, All Souls Church Unitarian in Washington, D.C. Yesterday, the pastor there, Reverend Robert Hardees, led his congregation in making a promise to provide sanctuary to those who feel vulnerable and oppressed by the incoming administration. I asked Reverend Hardees why he did that.
Yesterday on Sunday, 1,600 people showed up in church for our services, which is double our normal attendance. And what I'm hearing from folks is that they're grieving, they're fearful, and they're feeling vulnerable. I have Muslim members of my congregation who feel singled out by the president-elect for suspicion, immigrant members of the congregation who fear their deportation. On Wednesday afternoon, for instance, a couple in my congregation who I'm supposed to marry in May approached me and said, "Look at Rob, one of us is an immigrant and we feel like we have to get married before the inauguration. Will you marry us before Inauguration Day?" And I said, "Certainly I will."
And that couple wanted to get married sooner because why?
Yeah, they feared that one of them might be deported.
So let's talk about the immigrants, though, for a moment. I say someone fears deportation. What would they do now that your church is a sanctuary church? They would come to your church, and then what? How would it actually work?
We don't yet know what's going to play out in the Trump administration or how this will work. We can look back, though, to the sanctuary movement in the 1980s when churches like All Souls and other congregations in the country served as a kind of latter-day underground railroad for immigrants who were fleeing war and violence in Central America. In some cases, churches actually put folks up in the church basement, right, and provide physical harbor. In other cases, they worked with other social service agencies to provide food and clothing and services. So we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the Trump administration. We don't know exactly what it means, it will mean to be a sanctuary church in the Trump administration. But we're declaring our intent today that, you know, we want to be a sanctuary for those whose security or personhood is unjustly threatened in this new administration.
Donald Trump, as you know, has lashed out at sanctuary cities, places like New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Seattle, Philadelphia, right here, Cambridge, Massachusetts, all sanctuary cities. And P.S., since the election, they've all restated their commitment to remaining so. But do you That's know right. if Washington is able to make rules on either sanctuary cities or churches?
It's my understanding that Washington is also a sanctuary city. And we certainly support our mayor in continuing that commitment. But I'll say, Marco, that this idea of, you know, sanctuary cities goes way back to biblical times when the Israelite people were had escaped slavery in Egypt and were headed into the Promised Land. God said, "Wait, before you get into the Promised Land, I want you to make me a promise. I want you to say that you'll set aside cities as sanctuary cities, as cities of refuge for the alien resident." Among you, for the orphaned and the widows. So we're talking about a tradition that goes back to biblical times, and that's really where the origins of the sanctuary city and the sanctuary church come from.
I'm just curious, Reverend, in your quest for this kind of unity, I mean, people obviously in your congregation are fearful and are grieving, but I mean, how do you kind of recognize the fact that there's also a chunk of this country that is not fearful and is not grieving?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you have to acknowledge that. Those people tend not to be the folks in my congregation right now. But I think there is a recognition that there are folks who are excited. And I think there is also a recognition that there is common cause among some of the desires and hopes of Trump supporters and some of the desires and hopes of folks who supported Hillary Clinton. And so I think that there are opportunities to come together around those kinds of issues.
Reverend Robert Hardees of the All Souls Church Unitarian in Washington, D.C., thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. All this week on the show, we'll be featuring stories from our language podcast, The World in Words. And to kick off this wordful week, I've got one half of the podcast, Nina Porzucchi, in the studio with me. Hey there, Nina.
Hey, Marco. Wordful. That is a mouthful.
You like that? Yeah. Well, it's full of words this week. What story do you have for us today?
Well, today I actually have a story out of California. California had a little bit of exciting language news last week in the election. They passed Proposition 58,
right,
which overturned a ban on bilingual education.
Right. Reported on that on Friday.
Yes, you did. And this story actually has nothing to do with bilingual education, but we are talking to a couple of bilingual and trilingual folks. I recently was in Salinas, California, in the Central Coast. Have you ever been to Salinas?
I have, yeah.
So you probably know fields everywhere, right?
Artichokes, right?
Artichokes, broccoli, strawberries. I mean, everything that you could ever grow. People in Salinas like to call their valley the salad bowl of the world. And I was there at Natividad Hospital It's the major medical facility serving many of the farm workers who labor in those fields. Mm. In fact, there are fields that even surround the hospital.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. And many of the patients coming to the hospital are Spanish speakers. But several years ago, the hospital did an assessment of just who was coming there, and they realized that many of the patients actually didn't speak Spanish at all, or maybe very minimally, but they did speak native Mexican languages, Triqui, Mixtec, Zapotec, these kinds of languages.
Mixtec and Zapotec and Triqui, I mean, these are native languages, and they have no relationship at all to Spanish, right?
None whatsoever. And I wanted to see firsthand how the hospital staff and doctors are dealing with these speakers. So I hung out at Natividad Hospital for 2 days to watch and see how they're communicating with their patients. And here is an excerpt from my story from the World in Words podcast.
Where are we going, Ezra?
We're going to be going to MIU, Maternal Infant Unit.
Okay. So are you going to be interpreting?
Yeah, probably me or Sergio.
Oh, Sergio.
Yeah.
Israel Jesus is 20 years old. He's a medical interpreter at Natividad. His coworkers, the other interpreters, they call Israel el bebé. And despite his very adult, crisp blue blazer and his dress shoes, they're very nice, he does have this kind of baby face, the sweet, toothy grin. He has dimples. Fittingly, today, El Bebe is interpreting for two new parents and their baby daughter. Israel is trilingual. He speaks English, Spanish, and Triqui. That's what you were hearing right there. It's a native Mexican language spoken in parts of the rural mountainous state of Oaxaca. Triqui is a tonal language, a pre-Columbian language. It's about as related to Spanish as, I don't know, say English is to Mandarin. And it's one of a number of indigenous Mexican languages that are being spoken here in California. Israel is soft-spoken. He mumbles a bit. It's a trait I have been told that many Triqui people share. Several years ago, you'd never have found a Triqui interpreter like Israel roaming the hospital's corridors. In fact, you would have been lucky to find a certified Spanish language interpreter at Natividad. This was a problem. A problem that became clear to Linda Ford when she became the CEO of the hospital's foundation nearly a decade ago.
I first went into the emergency department and asked one of the doctors, is there anything you need here in this emergency department? And he was so frustrated and just said, oh my goodness, I can't talk to my patients. I cannot talk to my patients.
Linda found that it wasn't just communicating in Spanish that was an issue. Four of the most commonly spoken languages of patients coming to the hospital were native Mexican languages. And within those four native Mexican languages, there were dozens of variants.
And it was just amazing because I thought, well, I'll just hire indigenous interpreters. So let me find an agency that can provide interpreters. And I Googled indigenous languages to try to find interpreters, and nothing came up on the Google. Maybe there were interpreters in Australia, but nothing else.
So what Linda thought would be just a minor problem to fix turned into something much, much bigger. Two of the patients that Natividad doctors couldn't talk to were Israel's parents. In 2010, long before he was an interpreter, his mom brought his baby sister to the hospital. She was sick with a fever. His mom, who only speaks Triqui and a little bit of Spanish, went to the emergency room, unable to communicate just how sick her daughter was.
They were in the hospital like around 8 hours waiting. And the baby had a fever and really high fever, and then at that time the doctors didn't know what to do, and then they put a tube on it and cables, and one of the tubes that they put it in her mouth crossed in her heart. So
the cable crossed her heart, and his little sister died. And all of this occurred while Israel's mom had little grasp of what was going on.
So that's why, for my little sister, that's why he became an interpreter.
For his sister, he says, that is why he became an interpreter.
That's incredible. So how, Nina Porzuki, did the hospital even find a man who speaks tricky like Israel and all these other interpreters.
They had this realization that when they were walking around the hospital, there were tons of interpreters. Everywhere you look, there were interpreters in the waiting room. There were folks that were informally interpreting. So the hospital set about creating an interpreting service by training people, you know, who by day work in the fields.
So you find them, first of all, and then what are some of the challenges for training people in, you know, new words, I guess?
There are tons of challenges. Many challenges include just the sheer fact that lots of these native languages do not have words for things like C-section or catheter or stent. Tons of medical terminology that we have in English and Spanish and lots of other languages that just don't exist. And also concepts that are a little more difficult to translate. For example, I learned that in Zapotec, the word for tuberculosis, when you translate it, is "the devil is strangling my neck." So,
incredible.
Yeah, wow. So how do you, like, as a medical interpreter, say, like, oh, you have the devil is strangling your neck disease? So there are lots of challenges in figuring out, like, how to not only translate words, but translate an idea about what medicine is, culturally translating.
That's fascinating. So we got a taste of the story. You can hear the whole podcast, listeners. Find The World in Words on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll be featuring stories all week from The World in Words right here on the show. Nina Porzucchi, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Okay, a quick look at something we got coming up later here on The World. It was a weekend of somber commemoration in Paris. 1 year ago, 130 people were killed in a string of terrorist attacks in the French capital. Since then, survivors and families have been trying to put their lives back together. This man lost his daughter and found solace in writing a book about her.
When I wrote, I could write about my daughter, about what happened, without crying, simply, without breaking down. So it has helped a lot to write, and then publishing the book has helped also because I met readers and I met some people with very similar experiences, and this is a very moving experience.
We'll hear more from Paris a year later, still ahead here on the program. You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Still ahead, America's military and their families are about to get a new boss. And not all of them approve of the choice.
How can we continue to serve and continue to support our troops? And those people we're married to, right? In the face of maybe having somebody in the White House who we don't think is the best fit.
That's ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. During the presidential campaign, Donald Trump spoke often about his love for Israel, and many there cheered his victory. Now some Israelis are questioning that support after Trump selected Stephen Bannon as his White House chief strategist. Bannon is the head of Breitbart, a website linked to what the Anti-Defamation League calls unabashed anti-Semites. So how does that square with Israelis? I put that to Alison Kaplan-Summer, a Tel Aviv-based reporter for Haaretz.
Well, it kind of depends which Israelis you ask. Israelis who are very ideologically committed to settling the West Bank and are against peace deals with the Palestinians responded ecstatically to the election of Donald Trump. Other Israelis who are more in tune with some of their American Jewish counterparts who have great misgivings about Donald Trump and what he stands for are less excited. And many people think that he's such a loose cannon, has changed his position so many times that even these people on the right shouldn't necessarily count their chickens before they're hatched and should wait to see what his real Middle East policy turns out to be.
It's just extraordinary that the people who support settlements feel they're more important than the appointment by Donald Trump of someone who often panders to white nationalists and anti-Semites.
Well, it's really interesting. Each side decides to play up the anti-Semitic undertones of their opponents and downplay or ignore or dismiss the anti-Semites on their own side. And in this case, people on the right have been saying for a long time that the progressive and hard left ally with pro-Islamic, with Muslim organizations that have connections with Hamas and really have demonized the left as being anti-Semitic. And now the shoe is a little bit on the other foot, whereas the left is pointing to the right at people like Steve Bannon, who are behind Donald Trump, and saying the same. So really, just in a moment, the tables have turned.
Are you saying anti-Semitism is situational for some Israelis?
Yeah, I guess you could say anti-Semitism is in the eye of the beholder, right?
So Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was pretty quick to congratulate Trump and said how he's a friend to Israel. Has there been any reaction on the Bannon appointment from the Netanyahu government?
No, I mean, first of all, Prime Minister Netanyahu is very happy to see Barack Obama go. He would have been happy if it had been Hillary Clinton replacing Obama or Donald Trump replacing Obama. But his relationship with the White House is sort of an unprecedented disaster in the history of Israel-U.S. Relations.
So, Allison, it sounds like there's a big wait-and-see factor here, but what could this mean, the appointment of Steve Bannon? What could it mean for Israel's relationship with the U.S.?
It could mean some very harmonious times between Israel and the U.S. if, as promised, America is completely behind whatever Israel decides to do in the West Bank, good or bad. And that actually could lead to some very rocky relations between the American Jewish community and Israel, because the vast majority of the American Jewish community did not vote for Donald Trump and has serious misgivings about what's going on in his administration, especially after the appointment of Steve Bannon.
So just finally, I mean, the title of your article in Haaretz is Steve Bannon's appointment is a moment of truth for U.S. Jews. So spell that out for us. Why is this a moment of truth for Jews in the United States?
It's a moment of truth for Jews in the United States because I think for the first time, there's going to be real pressures on the American Jewish establishment, maybe not to cozy up so tightly to the American government and the U.S. government. And it's going to be caught between a rock and a hard place, because I think there's really a generation of progressive American Jews who will want to be on the side that is fighting President-elect Trump. And on the other hand, there's going to be the government of Israel, who whoever the American president is and whoever his aides are needs to deal with those powers. And it's, you know, sort of the security of the state of Israel is at stake. So some of those American Jewish establishment leaders are really going to have to figure out how to work both sides.
Allison Kaplan-Sommer with Haaretz in Tel Aviv. Thanks very much for your time.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Add environmental scientists to the list of those concerned about a Trump presidency. Trump's called climate change a hoax. He's also promised to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord. And now news reports on the president-elect's transition team suggest he's planning to do just that. This comes as the United Nations holds its first summit this week in Marrakesh, Morocco, on implementing the Paris deal. And as the U.N.'s weather agency reports that 2016 is likely to top 2015 as the hottest year on record. Reporter Susan Phillips is at the summit in Marrakesh. I asked her about the mood there today.
Well, Marco, it's actually a little bit better than it was last Wednesday, right after the election. That gloom seems to have lifted a bit. And the line you hear over and over is that the world, the rest of the countries that are party to this agreement, will soldier on with or without U.S. involvement.
So the U.S. delegation at the Marrakesh summit, it is the Obama White House delegation, and they're lame ducks. So what are they saying? What are they doing this week?
Well, of course, everyone here knows that the team can only negotiate something that lasts for the next 2 months. So when U.S. climate envoy Jonathan Pershing spoke today, he said they have not been contacted by the Trump transition team at all. But what he did say was that the momentum is strong, and he sort of made a push for the rest of the world to continue.
I cannot speak for the president-elect's team or to their outlook on international climate policy. What I do know, however, is that the power of the movement and the enormous momentum created in Paris and built throughout the year since. It's no longer a question of whether to accelerate the agreement's implementation, but rather a question of when and how.
Susan, Secretary of State John Kerry has been the one who's led the charge on climate in the Obama administration, and he's actually talked about locking in certain aspects of the climate deal before Donald Trump takes over. What can he really do, though? What is he talking about?
That's the big question here. And Kerry is planning to come. He'll be here tomorrow and Wednesday, and he's planning to make a big speech. So maybe we'll learn more later on this week.
If Donald Trump does pull out somehow of the UN climate deal, what does that deal look like without the U.S. Taking part?
Well, that's a good question. The U.S. contributes 20% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. And so, of course, it's a big player in the talks. It's also pledged money to developing nations. And the least developed nations are the ones, you know, who've got the most to lose if the U.S. pulls out and doesn't pay what it has pledged. Now, I spoke to Tozi Mpantu-Mpantu from the Democratic Republic of Congo, who leads the group of least developed countries here. And he had a wait-and-see attitude about the Trump administration, like at least a lot of people here do. And so far, all the countries that you've heard from have said they will continue with their commitments, including China. So it's one of those sort of bizarre situations where you do have a lame duck U.S. climate delegation and everyone else is sort of running around saying, well, with or without the U.S., we're still moving forward. And to be honest, what's ahead is pretty unknown.
Reporter Susan Phillips at the UN Climate Conference in Marrakesh. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Susan Phillips reports on energy and the environment for WHYY in Philadelphia. She's covering the UN Climate Conference with help from the International Reporting Project. It's been a year since ISIS struck at the heart of Paris. 130 people were killed and hundreds were injured on that warm November night as gunmen carried out coordinated attacks throughout the French capital. Yesterday, the people of Paris marked the anniversary by honoring the victims and survivors. Adeline Sia reports from Paris.
It was a somber day here in Paris, but people stood patiently in the cold rain to remember the 130 lives lost last year. French President François Hollande and Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo unveiled commemorative plaques at every location that was attacked last year, from the stadium to the terraces of cafes and restaurants and the Bataclan Theater. The victims' families had asked for a day of intimate ceremonies without political speeches, so families read remembrances, and in the 11th arrondissement, where many of the attacks occurred, a pianist performed for an eerily silent crowd in front of City Hall. Later on, brightly colored balloons, at least one for each lost soul, were sent off into the gray skies. Caroline Jolivet looks distraught, but she says the balloons are a heartwarming sight, especially for her 7-year-old daughter. Jolivet lost her husband last year at the Bataclan, and she says this has been a devastating year for her and her 2 children. It took no less than 3 days for her to receive confirmation of her husband's death. From the moment my husband's death was confirmed, she says, I decided the terrorist would not claim 3 more victims. I had no choice. I have to make sure my children have the most normal life possible. You need nerves of steel. For relatives of the victims, 2016 was the most trying year of their lives, but they had to find ways to cope. At a gathering of the 13-11-15 Victims Association, named for the date of the attack, Patricia Correa tells me she lost her only daughter, 35-year-old Priscilla, at the Bataclan. Correa learned important details about her daughter's last moments at the theater, the spot where she stood, the number of bullets she took, 5. But she will always wonder how long it took for her daughter to expire.
Alors on s'interroge aussi à savoir est-ce qu'ils ont agonisé puisque la police a empêché les secours d'arriver tout de suite.
We all ask ourselves, did they agonize, she says, since the police did not let first responders in immediately. Some people were shot multiple times and are still alive today. So you always have this doubt, did my daughter die instantly? or did she agonize and suffer? What we're living through is horrible. Correa says working with the Victims Association has been therapeutic. Georges Salines, the president of the group, lost his own daughter, 28-year-old Lola, at the Bataclan, and he wrote a book about her, a meditation on the value of her short life. He says his daughter loved music and roller derby.
I needed to write in order to put some distance between my pain and my thoughts. When I wrote, I could write about my daughter, about what happened, without crying, simply without breaking down. Then publishing the book has helped also because I met readers and I met some people with very similar experiences. And this is a very moving experience.
Aurélia Gilbert is also with the association. She survived the Bataclan attack last year and recently returned to the theater.
I was overwhelmed by all the emotions, a year of emotion, the fear, the mourning of the people who died there, the guilt of being alive and not them, everything.
In the aftermath, Gilbert has been reaching out to the families of the attackers, trying to understand what drives young people to turn on their own country and join groups like ISIS. As darkness fell yesterday, silent crowds converged on the banks of the Saint-Martin Canal, and people placed floating lanterns, blue, white, and red, on the water to honor the memory of the victims, lending this somber day some cheerful light. But just around the corner on Rue Alibert, where 13 people lost their lives a year ago, boisterous life goes on at Café Le Carillon. Tonight, there's a party at the bar, a choir is singing, and people are crowding the place, spilling onto its sidewalk. And at this moment, at least, it seems that Paris café terraces will never die. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
Back to the election, and one change we know is coming soon. America's 1.4 million servicemen and women are about to get a new boss when Donald Trump is sworn in as president and commander-in-chief on January 20th. Amy Bouchatz writes for military.com, and Amy, if we're to believe the pre-election polls, a majority of U.S. service members preferred Trump. But the day after the vote, you wrote this to your readers. Some of you are rejoicing, some of you are scared, but we all still need each other. Tell us why you put it that way.
So now that the election is, for all practical purposes, behind us, we're talking about ways that we can really move forward as a community and support our commander-in-chief, even though we may be a part of the community that doesn't believe that this person is the best fit for that role. Sure, there's plenty of military families who think that. So how can we continue to serve and continue to support our troops? And those people are we're married to, right? In the face of maybe having somebody in the White House who we don't think is the best fit. You know, that's really a matter of looking at some actionable steps, such as just the simple things that make up a community, like stepping up for your neighbors and making sure that we're, you know, taking care of each other.
Does the community of military families feel as divided as the rest of the country right now?
From what I'm seeing from our military.com readers, yes, the answer is absolutely yes. You know, the military is a microcosm of the rest of society. And so while choosing our next commander-in-chief is deeply personal, so is voting for our next president for the rest of society for a variety of different reasons.
And when I say military families, obviously I'm talking about U.S. military families on bases all over the world. Are you getting feedback from all over the world?
You know, we hear from our military families overseas. They don't know what's next for them. You know, anytime we switch commander-in-chief, there's a little bit of uncertainty there. What will benefits look like? What will paychecks look like? The commander-in-chief, the president, sets a lot of the policy, all of the policy that has to do with the military, and then Congress approves it or sets policy as well. And so there's always a lot of uncertainty about what that policy will look like. And because this particular election was so divisive, that uncertainty is higher.
Yeah, and it's not just Washington policy regarding military families. It's also about Washington rethinking the U.S. commitment to NATO and traditional allies like Japan.
I think what I'm seeing from our military.com readers is a lot of just admittance that we're going to have to wait and see. Military families can't do anything without the military giving them it's okay, right? Mm. So no one's going to move back stateside because of the uncertainty, right? They have to wait for the military to give them that order. And so it's really a wait and see game. But you know what? So is much of military life. We are always waiting and seeing for the next order or waiting for the next move or the next deployment or the next homecoming. And so this just sort of adds an extra level of stress to that, I think.
So as the Trump administration gets organized, aside from waiting, what will you be looking out for, Amy, on behalf of your readers?
Well, we're certainly looking out to see who becomes the next Secretary of Defense. That's a major sticking point, obviously. The Trump administration's statements or his statements about gay and lesbian service members are inconsistent, I would say. And so our gay and lesbian service members who only recently had the permission to serve openly and to have their families be a part of the military community are really looking at what's going to happen very closely. And many of them are afraid that they're not going to be allowed to serve anymore, that they're going to have to get out. And so I think we'll see a lot more of that sort of uncertainty and questions and, I hate to say it again, but waiting.
Amy Bouchatz is Senior Content Editor for Spouse and Family at military.com. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
This past week, we and much of the planet have been focused on the U.S. election and its stunning outcome, but that doesn't mean the world stopped making news. So here's a quick recap of some of the big stories from around the globe that have not been getting a lot of attention. First up, the battle for Mosul in northern Iraq continues. The Iraqi army is in the middle of a major offensive to retake the city from ISIS militants. The operation is supported by American air power, but in eastern Mosul, the fighting is mostly on the ground, and ISIS has responded with a wave of suicide car bombings against Iraqi forces and civilians alike. Here is what a civilian survivor told a BBC team reporting in the area.
Please, God, why is this happening to us? Why are they fighting this way? Why are they not fighting man to man? Why are the Islamic State fighting with car bombs? They are not real fighters. This is not a real man.
The fighting in Mosul has been going on for weeks now, and the Iraqi government said it could last a long time still. Another big story over the weekend came from Colombia, where the government and the FARC rebel group announced a new peace agreement. You'll recall that a previous deal to end decades of war in Colombia was rejected in a referendum last month. Critics argued the original agreement was too lenient on the rebels. The new plan includes some changes, but it's unclear if it goes far enough to address that criticism. Still, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos said he hoped the new pact would unite his divided nation.
Este acuerdo renovado, ajustado, precisado y aclarado debe unirnos.
This new and more specific peace accord should unite us, not divide us, said Santos. He invited all Colombians, whether they voted for or against the previous agreement, to give peace a chance. Meanwhile, in India, Prime Minister Narendra Modi today defended his decision last week to withdraw large denomination banknotes from circulation. The move is supposed to help tackle corruption and tax fraud by eliminating the 500 rupee and 1,000 rupee bills. The immediate result, though, has been to create a national cash crunch as millions of people wait in huge lines at banks to exchange the banned notes for new ones. And the Indian economy, which relies heavily on cash transactions, is in chaos. And one more story that you may have spotted last week about a polar bear in China named Pizza. He's been dubbed the world's saddest polar bear, and I would have to agree with that. Pizza had been the subject of international outrage after it emerged that he'd been living in a small enclosure inside a shopping mall in Guangzhou, China. Over the weekend, Pizza was moved to a new place where he has more space and can spend at least some time outside. But it's only temporary while Pizza's mall enclosure is renovated. In response, a group, Humane Society International, put out this statement. We implore the mall to make this a permanent move. No amount of renovation could ever make a shopping mall a suitable place for this animal. We'll end the show today with a musical tribute of sorts to Pizza the Polar Bear. It's a great tune called Stranger in a Strange Land by Leon Russell. As you may know, Russell died this past weekend. So in his honor, Leon gets the last word. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Yeah.
PRI, Public Radio International.